Skadoosh! In honor of Kung Fu Panda 4, in theaters this weekend, it seems like a good time to ask, what is DreamWorks Animation's best movie?
I'm Katie Rich, and because my actual answer, I think, is about to get chosen, I'm going to shoot my shot for the future. The trailer today came out for The Wild Robot, their upcoming adaptation of a really excellent children's book, and the trailer is beautiful, and I'm just going to make a prediction. I think that might be their best animated movie.
They're getting artier.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Finally. I'm Matt Patches. I'm going with, because my answer was also taken later in this lightning round, I'm going to go with my second choice, which is How to Train Your Dragon, which the music alone sends it into the top three, at least. But
that's,
you know,
the one
boy
I would
and
have
his dragon.
If it's you sweet. Hadn't taken it. His dragon's like a cat. What's not to
Dave's
like?
Going to take mine now.
Well, I'm David the Seven, and apparently have picked a very good DreamWorks Animations movie. I'm going with Kung Fu Panda 2, using inner peace to deflect cannonballs and a Kung Fu story about Gary Oldman's peacock villain using gunpowder. Looked great and is still fun.
I'm David Ehrlich, and, you know, I feel like I need to rewatch some
Shrek,
of these with my
Shrek,
kids
Shrek, Shrek.
In order to really understand
trolls,
their virtues.
Trolls,
but,
trolls, trolls.
I'm going to say they're all bad.
You might, that's not an unreasonable answer.
I think I'm looking at a little graphic of all of them put together here after I Googled
Ants?
DreamWorks animated movie.
With Woody Allen?
I mean, it's been...
No, David, just pick Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, a genuinely
yeah, like
good movie.
I mean, you and your... Antonio Banderas.
That's right. Famous for it. Me and Antonio Banderas.
I mean, it says
Boss,
that Orion
baby,
in the
Boss,
Dark.
Baby.
Is
yeah.
the DreamWorks
Orion
production?
In the Dark. Yes, it is.
All right. So I guess I'll go with that. Why not?
All right.
Recent topic of discussion on this show.
But they're all bad. Bad studio. Hope they get better. They don't really seem to be interested in getting all the better, but maybe Robot in the Wild will turn it all around.
The Wild Robot.
Whatever.
Featuring the voice of Lupita Nyong'o.
The robot?
Yeah. It's good. You should read the book. It's really good.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine. I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 465. It's the week of Wednesday, March 6th. And on that day in 1836, it was the Battle of the Alamo. I've heard of it. After 13 days of fighting Mexican soldiers, overwhelmed the Texan defenders.
Mm-hmm. That's all the facts we need right now.
They lost the Alamo, and yet we remember it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I can add the history thing to this. It was such an overwhelming victory because they killed them all. And people were like, oh, no, scary Mexicans are coming in and killing us. And so the Texas Army swelled in number after the Battle of the Alamo.
Unfortunately, anytime American people are saying, like, never forget, it doesn't usually bode well for anybody or reflect well on anybody.
Do you know why they were battling over the Alamo? Do you know? Why
it, was like, it was a fort, right?
It was a, pop
like,
quiz.
It was a
it was
mission.
It was like a military defensive location, right?
Yeah.
But why do you understand what conflict it was part of? It was part of like the revolt against Mexico, right? And that would lead to the annexation of Texas.
Yeah, they went and stole a fucking cannon from Gonzales, Mexico, which is where we get the Gonzales flag, which I only
really?
Know about because it's my last name. But it's a flag that flew on the top of the Alamo that has a picture of the cannon and it says come and get it. The Mexican
Another
soldiers
classic
overran.
Episode of our movie podcast.
Yes. I'm sure
and this was not your punishment.
Have you seen the Ron Howard version of the Alamo?
No.
David?
No. Did that happen? Was that Ron
Neither.
Howard?
No,
Neither
no,
have
no
I.
He didn't
no.
he didn't
it
make
was
that
John
movie.
Lee Hilko, right? No.
Yeah, it was definitely not Ron Howard.
Whoa.
I just Googled the Alamo expecting to find the movie like a moron.
The 2004 Alamo. John Lee Hancock.
John Lee Hancock. I was close.
That guy.
Yeah.
He has made a number of films, surprisingly.
I believe Ron Howard was supposed to make it at one point and dropped out.
Well,
I was thinking. Oh, Ron Howard made The Missing.
Yes, he did.
Tommy Lee Jones Kate Blanchett West.
I think which is not about the Alamo.
We're overly punishing people before they even know what they did wrong.
This is about movies. What are you talking about? This is what people want.
We're all here. We can talk about Dune 2 later on. We're going to talk about the Alamo when Dune 2 was on the docket, but there are no reviews. So
yes.
Your punishment's coming in two parts. Stay tuned for the mini segment later on. Well, you'll hear in-depth discussion of video games, but probably not the one you're expecting.
Circling back to Zelda. A big conversation.
I mean, there's nothing but circling back to Zelda in my life, which is how this mini segment happened. But first, David and I are going to punish you more. David, what do you think is going to happen on the final episode of The Traitors?
I think it's going to be stupid and suck. And I think my real prediction is that I'm going to text a bunch of people I know about how shitty the American version of this show is, like I do every fucking week.
Oh, my God.
I'm mad you haven't been texting me, even though I disagree.
I tweeted you about it.
That's what real friends do.
Yeah. I mean,
I disagree that it's been shitty because it's been very entertaining. But I do think now that the most entertaining narrative is completely over, it's the final episode feels like a real sidebar. Like, who cares?
Yeah, I mean, but the show, I mean, you and I think disagree with what we find entertaining about the show. I mean, you were saying to me on Twitter that it was entertaining it divorced from the quality of the play. And
yes.
I feel that too large a percentage or a portion of what makes Traitors good is the quality of the player, like at least the sincerity of it. And, you know, they don't necessarily have to be the best players in the world, but that is not what I mean. But like, they have to be sort of doing their best to make interesting choices and have a certain amount of skin in the game and for it to be emotional enough to compensate for their lack of strategy. And all of these elements are missing from this season, the US one. And it really started with Kate, who's one of my least favorite, Kate Chastain, one of my least favorite reality personalities I've ever seen. She was a fucking wet blanket.
And you're below deck? Yeah, yeah.
Total wet blanket on below deck, but so much worse in this context, where she isn't on the job. I mean, she's like in a service position on below deck. And here she is acting like she doesn't want to be there, but it's not a job. It's an opportunity to win a bunch of money and also entertain us in the process. And she is acting as if she doesn't want to be there. And she's like minor key sociopathic and not in a way that I think serves the game. And I think she was sort of the beginning of the end for this season. And everyone is all that it's all just amplified what is wrong with the US edition. All this talk about Bravo people versus other networks and their allegiances. And this is not how the game works. It doesn't make sense. Now it's played. They divide it up into two teams. All the traitors were on one of the teams. and Peter, you know, and Trishelle had it all figured out. And it was just watching the chips fall.
They were so obnoxious about it, which is why it didn't work out for Peter at the very least, which I find, like, I think it's okay for the game to work differently with the American one and for it to be like, all right, there's going to be alliances. There's going to be people who know each other outside of this. And like, that's going to add to the drama. But it doesn't help when you have the two traitors being Fedra and Kate, neither of whom really need the money or care about the outcome of the game. Like,
well,
that is what started falling apart for
Kate
me.
Kate Chastain,
you're right,
doesn't need the money. I mean, she has more money than I do, probably, but like, that's not saying a lot. I mean, she's just had a kid. She's on reality television. You know, she has like a podcast related to a reality television show.
Look vulnerable and look like they need it, right?
No.
Like,
I mean, you're right. I mean, I'm the first person to make the argument that the other versions of the show are so much more interesting when you have real people who haven't been, you know, honed on reality TV, who are telling you what they need the money for, and they are not already, you know, in the entertainment ecosystem, and they need it to pay for their house or get their mom surgery or raise their, you know, whatever the case might be. And this is all so much less interesting as a result. And I think in a better world, not the world that we live in, the executives of Peacock would take a long, hard look in the mirror and realize what is so engaging about other versions of the show that is lacking from their own. But it has been an enormous hit for them because people cannot resist the like moths to a flame of these washed reality stars we've been watching for so long and have given us all they have to give. And I don't foresee any change coming, but it's not too late to cast me on season 3. That's all I'm saying.
It's not.
That's all I'm saying. I put this wish into the universe. I've tried to manifest it. It's not too late.
I will say what I'm rooting for, which is that Sandra, who is the Queen of Survivor and has won twice, pulls some weird shit in the final episode and manages to eliminate some faithfuls and gets more of the money for herself. She's who I'm hoping on to add some gameplay back into this.
She's been real quiet.
Real quiet. I know.
That can be a good strategy.
I know. I'm hoping she's lying in wait for some chaos. So punishment over. Everybody should watch The Traitors. Part two of punishment. Still
no, punishment almost over. My final thought is that I just feel like anyone who deserves to win is already gone, and that frustrates me.
Fair. Well, then, if you want to leave us a review and avoid this, someone else is going to tell you how to do that.
Yeah,
people are going to eat this shit up. They're going to start deliberately not leaving us reviews so that we rant about The Traitors.
You go on the Apple Podcast app and leave us a review in the U.S. store if you're outside of the U.S. or want to talk to us about something else. You know, correct me on the Alamo, I guess, whatever. You can email us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. All right, on with the show now. It's the dream.
All right, Patches, you want me to start by asking you questions? No, you
I
should
guess
just, just start by explaining what you've been up to. Just give us the rundown.
Patches, no, explain
why
yourself.
Why do you want to hear this?
Patches, every week that we have signed on to record this show, you've been like, oh my God, I'm so tired. I've been directing a bunch of five-year-olds for the last 3 hours. And every week we're like, why are you doing this? And you're like, there's going to be a school play. And the school play finally
happened. I think it actually goes back further than that. When he when he signed up for doing it, he was like, I'm going to do this. And we all
and oh my God,
waited.
I'm going to be so tired.
I don't know if he started with that. He seemed kind of excited when he got the chance. But maybe that's all been kicked out of him through the process.
Look, I'm a theater kid. We've talked about our past in the theater. And I got swarmed at a playground during a meetup for kindergarten parents. And,
swarmed.
Swarmed by school play producers to participate in something that has been going for apparently 20 years at my
They just saw
school.
Something in your eye that was like, he looks like a theater kid all grown up.
I think they were ready for anyone to say yes, as I would soon learn that not very many people sign up for this experience, which is not just to like do a school play, but to be part of a school play review where you have to write your own play. You have or like 5 minutes of sketch and song and dance. And so, yes, as you mentioned, I've been doing this since December. Why you're fascinated this, we should dig into it because I don't know why. But I will say, why does it have a transcendent meaning to our podcast listeners that I would do something like this? I think a few reasons as I reflect on it. Creative pursuits in your older age. Find them. You need them.
Mm-hmm.
They're important. And that there are smaller stakes things than like being successful online and or being successful in like your professional life. I feel like this was very good for me to find an extracurricular that is creative, that has no stakes whatsoever. I will not become famous for doing a very good job writing a funny play.
A very good job if you do say so. If you do say so.
Yeah, wow, the reviews are already coming in.
I got some pats on the back for being out of the box, I will say. I should say the play that we did and my daughter was involved in, it was a K-5 production. So I spent a great deal of time with elementary schoolers, and I will get to the impact of that and why it is essential for all of us. If you ever become a parent, you need to spend time with kids and outside of your own parenting experience, because they show you who they really are and they tell you secrets, and because you're not their real parent, and we'll get there. But like, I did a big play about cave people discovering bowling, and they danced to Tub Thumping because you get knocked down, you get back up again.
Uh-huh. Excellent.
They
yes.
were throwing rocks. It was a Rock Dream Ballet. Did a little nod to
how long was it? How long is your play?
This was 5 minutes long.
Wow.
And it felt like 100 years long because it takes some time. And every day was like a team sport. I'm definitely buying a whistle next year when I probably do this again, even though against my better judgment, I should reclaim my life.
Yeah, because your younger child is so far from starting elementary school. You could be doing this for 10 years.
It's very possible I'd do this for 10 years. The look in the eyes of the producers who asked me if I was coming back definitely made it seem like I was about to do this for 10 years. Why you should do something like that? I had a lot of parents come up to me after we did it and said, why would you ever do this? It's so much time. It's so much commitment. It's so much brain power. It's like a lot of working with other parents. That's the hard part. It's like running a company, a lot of communications, a lot of emails, a lot of coordination. I would say
my nightmare.
And why it is important for this podcast to talk about it is that it's, again, about understanding what kids like and knowing your kids. And I feel like we have a lot of discussions, maybe not so much on this podcast, but I do in parent circles, but it is pertinent to what people care about when they listen to the show, which is like culture and what is emerging and what kids really care about. And I do think what I learned from doing the play is that kids care. We think that kids don't give a shit about the old mediums and maybe just like dancing around and having fun. They're glued to their computers and they're glued to the screens. And actually kids love to engage with like dumb comedy and the thing we can, adults and kids can come together and laugh over the same things. And you can like watch, we can dance to Chumbawamba as long as we cut out the parts about doing shots and we don't reference that Dave Gonzalez has drank the tub thumping. We didn't do any drinking of the tub thumping during the play. But I do think there's like a lot of common ground still with young people. And without pushing your culture on them, you can share your culture with them and find something fun to do. But maybe the most interesting part was when we spent 10 weeks practicing this, the actual play, which was this past weekend, why you're asking me about it is like I spent 4 days in a classroom with my group of 12 elementary schoolers just waiting for our turn to go on. I spent a lot of time just asking them questions about like
who they are and
what they do.
You're going to get into what this was, but like, yeah. Why was it 4 days? How many performances were there?
Well, there was a dress rehearsal and then three performances.
Three performances?
A Friday night and a Saturday, Sunday.
Oh,
we're putting on a show.
God.
The whole town comes to this thing.
How many other skits are
there? Also, if you don't have one of these at your own town, you should start one.
Oh, my
this
God.
This is important.
Sounds like a ton of
work
skits.
To start. It's like a 70-minute production.
Wow.
And then you all dance at the end. We dance to the Owl City song from Wreck-It Ralph 2 at the end. And I was like, this Owl City... let's just go on a detour.
I
here.
Do not like
Owl
where
City
this is going.
An affront
yes.
to culture
oh, okay,
itself.
Good. There we go.
Okay, Owl City yeah. sucks ass. Yeah. It is a Postal Service ripoff.
Yes.
That one song he did, I thought it was Postal Service for a long time, and then I realized it was Owl City, and there was no relation. And like you're a hack, man.
I
and then he did
the
song
what
for
the
Record
song is.
Ralph
what
2,
is
and it's not a banger, but like when you get a 200 kids in a room with their parents like dancing to it, it's kind of fun.
Is this all just kids from your one elementary school who do this?
Yes, and none of the other elementary schools in our district do anything like this, which seems rude.
Man, the whole town comes even to see kids who they don't know.
Comes. Yeah.
Wow.
Because what else are kids doing? And they should. Yeah. And you
it's
know
for, it's
friends
for people like me, Katie, where their good friend Matt Patches is like, spend some time with children. I'm like, that's actually very difficult for me. Without yeah. gaining certain looks, I could go see this production
that's
you know,
true.
Saturday evening and have a perfectly fine time with it.
Wow.
My big note is that kids do not know how to act or how to... You have a fear of child actors, Katie.
I don't have a fear. I want them to be in school and doing things like this rather than being on movie sets.
Yeah, I just don't know. Working with kids... I don't understand how anyone can be a kid actor and like what it takes, how broken you would have to be able to take direction,
mm-hmm.
like working with a third grader. They want to run around. They
uh-huh.
don't want to listen. And it's a team sport.
Because you're getting
Next
them
year,
after
I'm buying
school,
a whistle.
Right? Like they've been listening
oh
in
God.
School all day and then you get them and they're like,
I got them at 5 o'clock.
Oh my
Some
God.
People were smart and did like after school, 2 o'clock rehearsals. But I did 5 o'clock.
Because you have
of
a job.
Time commitments.
Yeah. So they,
yeah, it was most of my other.
They've had freedom and then it was cruelly ripped away.
And they were just, yeah, and they were just drained and like, they don't want to be there at all. I don't understand how kid actors function on set. because they are want strange. To play and they want to be around other kids. And yeah, that's it's pretty scary. I don't know how you would take the leap there. And obviously many, many, many do. But you're pretty broken. You'd have to be to be a kid who can actually focus in that way.
Yeah.
Not to shame kid actors. If you're listening, Haley Joel Osment, I apologize.
You know, hopefully many of them turn out okay and get to have normal lives. That's what we were for. Were you going to talk about Mr. Beast before we wrap up your
Okay, so this
experience?
Is the thing. Here's my two things for all parents listening and for all people who want to know, like, where we are with YouTube. I am just in awe of how kids, and we would have done this. I have to assume that David spent his youth breaking school computers and like cheating the world and like playing with
cheating
it. Feels
the
like
world?
A David thing. I just feel like you did whatever you wanted when you were a kid, that you didn't follow the rules and that you had like you were playing games on school computers and being like, I can do anything on my school computer. That just feels like you. Like a mad
genius. I don't know if that qualifies as like cheating the world and doing anything that I want, but I did fuck around on my school computer. That is true.
What did you play on your school computer?
A lot of
when you were
Oregon Trail, African Trail was a big one.
But those were loaded
like
on
Turbo
the
Turbo Racer.
That was
yeah,
allowed,
I wasn't
right?
like sneaking, Amazon. You know, black market software onto my school's computers.
Did you guys have TI-83 calculators? When
oh
you played,
yeah,
like, drug wars.
Yes. Yeah, very Ooh. Much.
That felt edgy.
There was a the off topic but slightly related tangent. There's a podcast called Search Engine. It's the new PJ Vote podcast. And this week's episode is with Ben Brode talking about how to make an addictive card game. And he started by programming on those TI-86. Yeah, the Marvel Snap Hearthstone guy.
Is that the Marvel Snap guy? I don't know He's who hype. Makes this game. I just know that I play
Don't
a
you
lot.
Watch the update videos about what cards
you
are
know
coming?
This your entire life.
Anyway, sorry, Pat, just go ahead.
No. To wrap up, I was just going to say, like, the advantage of figuring out what extracurricular can do with kids, and the theater is a good one because there's a lot of sitting around sometimes, and you can let them go on their school laptops and, in theory, do homework, is the anthropological study that I was able to conduct of third graders and what they do with their time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Katie, how old is your son is going into what, second
he's
grade?
He's in second grade.
He's in second grade. Okay.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something about second graders that I've learned.
All I feel like I know some things.
All of them get laptops now.
Yes.
And they are restricted to certain sites. Like, it can't do everything that a normal laptop could do. Here's the thing. Yes, it can. And the kids are very game to tell you, if you are not their immediate parent, that they can find anything that they want on their computers. I only have YouTube Kids. No, they don't. The kids are great at somehow navigating around the barriers. And because of older kids, I have to imagine it's like older siblings passing down the knowledge of these sites that they go to. And you know, YouTube is one of them. And as you alluded to, Katie, Mr. Beast, who has 261 million subscribers on YouTube. If you're not familiar with Mr. Beast, he used to be kind of like a YouTube prankster. He does like outlandish stunts. He has millions and millions of dollars. As Katie, he lives near you.
He lives in Greenville, Carolina. North Carolina, which is a very
studio.
Small town where much of the town works for him. I think the Washington Post did an article about this. Like,
he has 250 employees, and all he does is run.
Cannot imagine anything more uncomfortable than living in a town where everyone worked for me.
And you were a YouTuber. Yes, you'd be Mr. Burns, basically. It's
content. It's no longer a content factory. It is a content town. Mr. Beast continues to be huge, and sometimes with these gigantic YouTubers, it's like how. What is the appeal? How do they amass such a following? And it's with kids. Like, they're Mr. Beast's whole thing, if you read about him, he'll say this on podcasts, he'll say this on his own videos. He wants to create viral content. He doesn't want to entertain you. He's constantly looking for, like, how the algorithm works and what it takes to get into your brain and you know, to your point, Dave, how to make an addictive card game. It's that times 1,000. How to make an addictive video and how to completely warp YouTube in your image. That's what Mr. Beast has done and has worked. If you talk to third graders, they really want to watch all of Mr. Beast's videos. And he is a good person because he has transitioned from prank videos to philanthropy on some level. He does videos that are like, I have built 100 houses for unhoused people, or I have built 70 wells in Africa. And I was like, this guy just wants you to watch his videos so he makes millions of dollars. Do you know that? Because I'm a weird confrontational adult.
talking to third graders.
The good news is I'm not parenting them in this setting, so I could really disarm, but without going over the line, of course. And asking them, like, why do you like this guy? And he's like, and all of these kids in this room, I was just like, he is a good person. He is a scientist. But one kid,
scientist.
I thought that was strange. Maybe he went to college and got a degree. They love this person. They want to watch all his videos, and you can really zone out. And YouTube is a strange ecosystem right now where it's become like TikTok because it has YouTube shorts. And I'm like watching kids scroll through videos. I'm like, oh, this is what we all fear. And using their own laptops to do it, their school issued laptops. I definitely became like prudish school parent for a second. I don't know how to react to this. We spend a lot of time watching and talking about culture here in this room, and even our own parenting stuff. And this is still like, I'm so immersed in what Mr. Beast does and how he operates on YouTube, and he tries to get under people's skin. And I still feel like this is unknown territory. What do you let your kids do? How do you figure it out? I feel like all you can do is talk to them, but
yeah,
they are so ready to zone out to Mr. Beast videos for like 40 minutes and just sit there zombified. And here's the other thing.
But have you never zoned out zombified to some entertainment that was made directly for your brain? Of course you have.
Yeah, maybe that's fine. I don't have strong memories of doing that as a kid. Do you?
Yeah, I rewatched the VHS of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles first 6 episodes so many times. And then like probably around the exact same age group you're talking about, Patches. And it's so ingrained in my brain as something to zone out to.
Do you think Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is a comp for I built 70 wells in Africa?
I think you're...
Why are you against building wells in Africa? Maybe we should unpack that.
I'm not against building wells in Africa. I'm against weaponizing it as a form of like viral content to be like, I'm good and built brand building.
I mean,
you know what I'm saying?
But
like the Ninja Turtles were building brands by like putting themselves on like terrible breakfast
cereal. They
want
to sell you toys.
We have watched the Legend of Zelda cartoon from the 80s because, again, my household is obsessed with Zelda, and the god-awful gender dynamics in that show, like, that's the stuff that was being shoved down our throats at that point. And it was also brand building on behalf of Nintendo. Like, I don't see a huge difference there.
I mean, I've also watched probably...
Excuse me, princess.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that is... I've probably watched every Mr. Beast video since 2019, 2020.
Wait, really?
Wow.
Really?
Yeah, I've subscribed to all his channels.
That's because Dave is 12.
Well, also, it's like, that's what's working for the algorithm. So you watch it and you take it in like any other sort of media, and you're like, this is what's working for the algorithm. All of his videos, no matter what it is, if it's charitable or not, you will know exactly what he's doing the video in the first 15 seconds of the video. Mm. And then it keeps that propulsion.
Yeah,
and then when he's done, he's out.
Hyper cut all the funny bits into the very beginning to make sure you don't leave and then stick around for the pay.
He started doing this thing for his non-charity videos where when it's like cut into segments, so like you have 6 challenges or you're, you know, buried underground for 7 days. In between each one of those, he'll quote unquote blow something up, which is just like a After Effects thing. But it keeps like this weird pacing where there's like a visual and sound and story climax every 5 minutes, and you could just do it and like probably never learn anything. I don't know. It's weird because I guess if his advertisers were more sinister, that if I knew his advertisers were more sinister,
they probably are. But you know,
yeah, he has like weird shopping apps and stuff. But then now he's paying for it with his own products.
He also creates food, and now he has his own products. Yes, and so one of the kids that I met over the course of this play was like, I'm so into Mr. Beast, I go to 7-Eleven and buy his food.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
I mean,
now what you're saying, Katie, is you're right. This is not that different than, hey, this toyetic cartoon is just here to sell me more toys and cereal. I guess what I'm just like, I'm struggling to think of the it matters. Like, does it matter if they're watching a 23-year-old man weaponize philanthropy in the context of entertainment? Is that different than Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? That's a big question that I don't have an answer to, and I don't want to sound like I do, because it's a great unknown territory of his influence over YouTube is also, like, there's a lot of crappy copies of Mr. Beast that now exist too.
That's the stuff. So, like, I think, like, Mr. Beast at this point is, like, brand managed to a point that, like, it's not the same as Disney or Ninja Turtles or whatever, but it's relatively close. You're not going to turn on a Mr. Beast video and 5 minutes later be like, what? He's advocating for right-wing politicians? But that aspect of YouTube really freaks me out. Like, I have, you know, my kids don't really get onto YouTube very much because I'm very afraid of that algorithmic slide into all kinds of horrifying stuff that I have no control over. So I feel like Mr. Beast is really the safe zone in a YouTube that has a lot more bigger, more insidious problems that I can't see.
And that's sort of the genius of it. Like, imagine if when we were in high school, Jackass had a philanthropic arm.
I think, like, Jackass did have a philanthropic arm. It was Jackass was helping millions of people.
It was bringing joy to the masses.
They built bungee cord porta potties. 70 porta potties in Africa.
Only two of them attached to the bungees. Guess which ones? Oh.
I was watching Jackass 3 the other day, and that is still a moment of art. Steve-O going up in the porta potty with shit flying everywhere. So beautiful.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, David.
This conversation was mostly too scary for me to get involved. I'm just thinking about my kid watching, who I've let loose on YouTube, watch Danny Go, who is a Charlotte, North Carolina-based, upbeat.
Oh my God,
YouTube
North Carolina. Really,
I know,
just,
they're churning him out. And doesn't seem to have the same world-beating aspirations that Mr. Beast does. All I know about Mr. Beast is I watched exactly one of his videos. It was the one where they had people aged 1 through 199 to see which one was the best.
Oh, I watched that one too. Yeah. Why did that one get both of us?
Maybe it's because the 40-year-old won and it's targeting us.
Spoiler. I liked how the 50-year-olds just fought with each other the entire time. It was
I mean,
incredible.
I did not watch the whole video. I was skipping around.
Oh, I watched
so I'm happy
the
to say that I don't know
thing.
What you're talking about. I thought it was one of the most sinister things I've ever seen in my entire life. and I can't exactly put my finger on why, but it felt like it felt like watching Logan's Run or something, but with a laugh track. I mean, it made me ill.
Well, to quote a third grader that I
not know what it is, but one day
weekend.
I might have to know what this is. I mean, one day Asa might age into the Mr. Beast demographic, and we're going to have some very difficult.
Mr. Beast
as a third grader
for
was
us,
screaming at me, Mr. Beast is real and Blippi is the fake.
Oh, yeah. That's true. I mean, Blippi's more insidious than Mr. Beast, I would argue.
I don't know. He just goes and tours construction sites and shows you trains. I'm warming up to Blippi, but I'm also broken now. I don't know. YouTube, it's scary. It's weird. But all the kids are there and... Yeah, sorry, Dave.
Oh, one more question to kind of close out. You cut out the drinking part of tub thumping. Yeah. I'm assuming you also cut out pissing the night away because there's no way that you have a whole bunch of.
I think it's mostly up and down again. We fall down. What is?
We get knocked down. Then
just
get up again.
I just spent 100 hours like listening to this song, and now I can't remember. Yeah, the rocks and the cave people had to dance together.
Yeah, I just think kindergartners through fifth graders pissing the night away would have been so hilarious.
That's what they do sometimes.
Yeah, what music is this?
Let this segment have a positive ending, which is while I watch kids browse YouTube and scroll and felt some sense of doom there, I also stumbled onto another website that they all use called Kids Search. That's with a Z. Kids
of course it is.
Search.
Nice.
It is the safe, quote-unquote, version of Google for kids. It also has hundreds of games they all play that look completely unregulated. Like, if you thought Roblox was just a toxic wasteland of content, Kids Search, which they can access on their home computers. I'm really ruined. I'm such a narc when it comes to the elementary school fun. But, like, that was really troubling. And then we get in a room and, like, these kids come alive. And if you talk to kids and you hang out with them and you give them a creative mission, like, they'll really do it. And I'm not really scared of the digital age as it erodes children because we just need to give them something to, like, do. And I'm not sure we put up our end of the bargain a lot of the times. We're, like, so worried, but so many parents came up to me like, I would never do this. That sucks. Why not?
Yeah.
Put on a play.
You're competing with building outhouses in Africa. Step up your fucking game.
You need to compete with Mr. Beast. dance to Tub Thumping.
Love it. Great job, Pat.
Well, you've heard for weeks about Zelda. You've heard about my children. I think you have heard them maybe once or twice, but now I present Charlie and Sam on a drive from one errand to the library. Talk about Zelda.
Tell me what I need to do to beat Von Meadow.
Okay, so there's not really a tactic.
All right, what were you going to say, Sam?
Okay, so there's cannons, and then you have to shoot the cannons two times to get them exploded, and there's four cannons, and after you destroy all the cannons, you could go inside. You can also not touch the force field because it will just hurt you.
And what does Tiba do?
Give you 20 bomb arrows. Yeah, and when my mom did it, me and my brother bought some bomb arrows, and then Tiba gave us the 20, so we never ran out fighting for a meadow.
That's true.
So that's not that true. You want to know what me and you did, Sam?
Yeah?
We had no long arrows, so we only had the 20 that Tiba gave us, and I was terrible at it, so we failed, and then we had to go buy some arrows.
So how does Vomito compare to beating the other divine beasts? Like, is it easier?
It's one of the easiest, yes, I would say.
Which is the hardest?
I would say a really tough one to figure out how to beat the boss is Varudania.
Okay.
But then it's pretty easy to figure out how to beat the boss in Bonaboris, but the boss is really hard to beat. Like, you can know how to beat him, but also, it can be really hard to beat him.
Varudania is the lizard?
Yeah.
Okay.
And
on the volcano.
And the one in Bonaboris is actually pretty hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys scared me off of Bonaboris. You made me think I wasn't ready for it yet.
The puzzle is fine. It's just the boss. It took us, let's say a month of trying to beat it. So probably more than a month if we just kept trying over and over.
What do you guys think is the hardest thing you figured out so far? Like, what took the longest?
What took the longest?
Yeah.
Something that took very long was beating Varudania. I kept getting destroyed by magma bombs and moblins.
Magma bombs? What's a magma bomb? It throws magma bombs at you.
Not throw, but it just makes the volcano explode magma.
Okay. Sammy, what about you? What do you think was the hardest?
But I think it's the hardest that we completed is, I say, something that also took a long time was the Yiga Clan hideout. We had no idea that you had to throw bananas to the extract.
Oh, yeah. I haven't gotten to that. Where is the Yiga Clan hideout?
Kasura Valley.
Where's that?
It's in the Gerudo.
Oh, okay.
You gotta, go all the way to the back. And once you get to the back of the canyon, you'll see it's, this whole thing. And you gotta burn the right tapestry. I think it's, two away from the one in the middle. Is the one that leads to the hideout.
You burn a tapestry and, the hideout is hidden behind the tapestry?
No, the staircase hidden behind the tapestry.
Okay, that leads you to the hideout, okay.
And there's also a Gerudo trapped in there.
Alright.
Also, there is, two bananas in the starting room. And then there's one scout walking around. Throw the banana through him and then paraglide over him. But in the next room, first you're going to want to turn left, go up and keep going until you get to the banana room where there's like 20 bananas.
Oh, I remember you guys doing that.
There's a lot of scouts in this second room, so you're going to want to go around the balcony and distract as many of them as you can, and then eventually you're just going to have to go down there and sneak around and then throw bananas. And then at the end, there's a pretty easy boss.
All right, Sammy, if you could live in any community in Zelda, which one would you live in?
I would live in Terrytown.
Why? Turn on. All right, why would you live in Terrytown, Sam?
Because it has such nice music.
It does have nice music.
I would live in Rito.
Because it's so windy? I guess it's not as windy when you beat Windblight Ganon, huh?
Yeah. But they're still updressed when you're trying to fight Windblight Ganon.
Well, the updress kind of help you get where you need to go, right?
That's not true. There actually is. Oh, yeah, there is, like, one updress.
All right, let's go vote.
I thought we were going to get Kung Fu Panda.
You can do both.
Can we do Kung Fu Panda books first?
Okay, sure.
We're going to have to take...
Yeah, okay, Dune 2. Holy shit.
Who's going to start?
Oh my god, Dave should start.
I think we start with...
I want to do the Javier Bardem like whistle clicks, if I could do those. It would feel very Lila Crocodile coded to me, personally.
Oh my god, wow. You're obsessed.
Of course.
I'm glad that was your takeaway.
Uh-huh, that was my main takeaway from
Dune
2.
What are we talking about here? We're talking about Dune?
Dune Part 2 has become the first smash success of 2024. People are going to theaters. People are going to see it in large formats, which accounted for a lot of its box office. It opened around the same as Oppenheimer, but also, if you remember, around the same as Doctor Strange, Multiverse of Madness. So here, I have gathered myself and David Ehrlich, two people I know very well that didn't really like Dune Part 2. And the mystery is, what did Katie and Patches think about Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of the second half of the first novel, Dune? Let's begin.
Whoa, is that where we're starting?
I mean, did you guys know that this movie is really big, and if you can see it on a really big screen, it's really loud, and the sandworms are huge, and like everyone's beautiful, and cool stuff happens? Did you guys miss the part of Dune 2 where cool stuff just happens for a while, and then you get to go home?
No, I saw that cool stuff, at least for me, it was at the end. That was fun. There was just about an hour and 47 minutes of stuff before that made me bored or mad.
I did notice the part where I got to go home. I appreciated that.
I got to jump straight into the details, but the part where you've got Timothée Chalamet standing on the ridge of a dune waiting to ride that fucking sandworm for the first time is one of the coolest things I have seen in a movie, period, maybe? That's well before.
Period.
I mean, I don't know. It was just great. It was such an absorbing, thrilling... I was literally sitting in the third row of IMAX, so I was like in this movie. And I just got the tingly, like, oh my God, I'm seeing something incredible happen in front of my eyes feeling, which hasn't happened in, since Mission Impossible 7, like, I'm not saying it never happens, but it was a thrilling big screen experience, exactly what I was hoping for.
Yeah, I come at it the opposite direction of Dave, where for me, it was the hour and 47 minutes that followed that sequence that really bored me into oblivion.
We'll get there. We'll get there. Patches.
Yeah, I'm trying to pull way out and, it's not a good place to start with this movie. We're picking up halfway through the movie. It's a true part two. It's a big canvas. There's a lot of feelings. There's a lot of vibes. There's a lot of dense material that's being, I don't know, kind of steamrolled to just be as simple and maybe as pleasurable as possible. I'm almost at a loss of like where to start digging into this movie, if it even deserves it. It's actually so simple on many levels. But Katie, I was scrolling through Letterboxd after I came home from seeing Dune 2 the other night, and people were like, this is a sci-fi masterpiece. This is one of the great science fiction films that's ever been made. I don't know if you're feeling on that wavelength, saying that, like, looking at Paul standing on a sand dune waiting for a sandworm is like one of the great images you will see in film in your lifetime. Are you at that level?
No.
I think this movie is good, and I'm a little baffled by, like, what is capturing people here. And I don't want to psychologically break them down or trying to understand them.
Matt Patches today on Fighting, like, in the War Room.
What is going on? What is with this movie? Is this a Villeneuve thing? Is Villeneuve just, like, one of the guys now? Is he like a Nolan Hive guy?
Yeah.
Like, what is the attraction of Dune that he is able to do austere imagery, that he can work on such a big canvas and not have to be dumb about it, spend money, go big? Like, what is, I was looking through his filmography too. I'm totally split on Villeneuve. I really love Blade Runner 2049. I really love Enemy.
Blade Runner 2049 is a wild thing.
Well,
I don't like
Arrival either. I'm on the other side of the fence on that one.
That's a weird take too.
And Sicario, I'm just like totally didn't register for me at all.
I don't want to overlook the fact that Prisoners does suck, and I'm glad that you said it.
Yes.
Well, I have never been more harassed online about Prisoners. I reviewed that for IGN.
About
back
Detective
in the day.
Loki and whatever Hugh Jackman's stupid fucking name is in that movie.
You know,
I'm sure you know what it's like to be harassed by Denis Villeneuve fans.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like I was David reviewing Dune 2 out here in the wild. I'm pretty split on Villeneuve, but he seems like one of the guys, and maybe that's, I don't know what people are activated about with Dune Part 2. Like, why is this hitting so hard? Because it's like, not a lot happens. There's some cool images, but you think this movie's great.
I really do. I mean, I don't want to, like, take false valor. No, not false valor. Whatever.
Stolen,
like, I don't
want
to, like, bring up stolen valor for Star Wars, but I was talking to someone, I think it might have been Chris Rosen, kind of pointing out the idea that, like, this part two is, it kind of fills the Empire Strikes Back void for a lot of people, where you're telling the middle part of a story, you're following the development of this hero who may or may not really be a hero, and finding some really complicated shades of gray in that process, and further exploring this really complex world. And the thing that I was kind of frustrated by and then kind of continually amazed by is that this movie over and over again would throw me into a scene where I'd be like, wait, who's this? Wait, what's happening? How's Josh Brolin alive? What's going on here? And then it would catch me up to speed as the over the course. And for a story this complex in a world I'm really not that familiar with, I don't know a ton about Dune. I was just kind of in awe at how it managed to juggle all of that while still keeping the movement going. You know, does it have one too many scenes of a big machine blowing up in the desert? Probably. Like, I think the middle section gets saggy.
All of those are good.
They're all good, but you're like, okay, we're still doing this. Okay, here we go till the end. But the complexity of it and the scale, and I think the development of Paul Atreides as a character is genuinely well handled. You get to the end and you're not 100% sure how to feel, and that is a complex, hard thing for a movie to pull off, and I think it does it so well. It really sends you out on this note of thinking, wow, this guy really knows how to handle the story that he's telling, and that's a really hard ship to land.
Okay. I think you picked the wrong Star Wars Part 2. This is Attack of the Clones. This is the one where we don't like sand and where our hero breaks bad.
They don't like sand. Give me that.
The hero breaks bad. It does have some Empire Strikes Back familial things that, you know, is now on the big screen because David Lynch decided that was too much to deal with when he did Dune. But yeah, I think there are some fantastic sequences in this movie. I think the problem is it's intercutting. It's trying to get as many themes as it can from the books while completely ignoring others. And it just reducing what should be in the books and in other media has been a 2-year time jump to all of this happening in the same year. Really makes it have like a montage-y feel for me. As I've been putting it to people, in between when Lady Jessica drinks the blue water and then Paul drinks the blue water, that middle section for me is just like a jumble of stuff.
Blue water? I thought it was worm piss. Was that a
joke?
Or
vomit.
Worm, yeah.
We see it harvested, Patches. You should know.
That's true.
That worm harvesting sequence is so good.
That is good. Anything in this movie that gets specific, I was very much enjoying myself. And most of that is like Bene Gesserit stuff, where it's like, oh, there's real characters, there's real world building, there's real political intrigue here. And there's also piss harvesting from sandworm babies.
So you don't feel like the like Paul and Chani stuff feels
Paul
like real
people? Paul and Chani
people?
Is the stuff I don't really respond to so much in the movie, where I'm like, this is pretty tropey and broad, and I haven't spent a lot of time with them. I feel like the Paul arc, to your point, like is fully developed, I suppose. He gets to this point where he's just some noob coming to Arrakis in the first movie, figure out what he's doing here and what his family's doing here, and suddenly he is a messiah figure, and he's going to try and live up to the legend, and then he drinks piss, and then he's all seeing, and he's corrupted, and he's going to be the villain here. He's going to be a colonialist. I just couldn't have been done in one movie. I think if it could have been, if they could have compacted his story, and if I could have had momentum for him, I just think there's no momentum for the actual character work.
If you fit
in
it into
the,
one
in
movie, how would you make time for 3 hours of staring at large brutalist structures while Hans Zimmer just wails in the background?
I will say this, I like that part too. And I almost find Paul and Chani stuff distracting, because I thought the Zimmer score was like even better in this movie.
It is actually better.
Theme is really strong.
I was down on the Zimmer score in part one a little bit, but felt a little bit derivative to me, but the mournful lead theme that he uses in this movie.
Yes. I'm like, living for it
really
right now. Was
fucking
that in the first movie?
No, it wasn't.
Because I feel the same
way.
At
all.
Okay.
And
it's so good.
It completely, you know, when it's playing,
and
which
I'm
is
into
for like a solid
50%
of this film, completely transforms the texture.
Blow
the
up more H.R. Geiger ripoff art. I'm like very into the set pieces, and then when they go to the when we meet Austin Butler in the Harkonnen arena, like the deviation is kind of boring, but I love all the sets and getting off the planet, like take me off Arrakis. I guess I feel like everyone else on Arrakis, but I there's a lot to like and a lot to see in the movie, but weirdly the central story and characters I just cannot connect to, and I thought it was pretty boring.
I'm really there with you, because there was, even though I thought the first one was also boring, there was a lot of nuance to both Paul and Lady Jessica specifically that here gets flattened so fast. It's like Jessica gets taken over by her psychic fetus, and
right, she drinks piss, and then she's like off the deep end.
Goes full cult.
Gets face tattoos. That's never a good sign.
Yeah, goes full cult. So we're no longer seeing.
She went to Burning Man. She's having a midlife crisis.
She went from I need to do everything to protect Paul to, but also he needs to become the Death Messiah just with one little blue sip of drink. Not since Romulan ale. Sorry, that's my Jordan Hoffman impression.
Wasn't she trying to protect him from the Bene Gesserit, right? Like, that she has to, like, keep him from revolting against them. Like, isn't all kind of part of her overall goal to let him fulfill their prophecy?
I mean, but also, like, realizes that there is a very good chance the poison's going to kill him, but pushes him to do it anyway. Anyway, it's not important. The nuance there is gone. With Timothy Chalamet, we have to stop his sort of, because he has the whole, you made me into this, I don't want this inside the tent in part one. We sort of pick up like you already remember that really well. And his story becomes like learns to catch a sand Uber, like proves he can commit terrorism. And I'm like, I get this, but this is not specific enough to whatever fucking prophecy it is. And then they sort of rope him into Stilgar, who, you know, Javier Bardem's kind of playing as a comic character, to the point where it's like a meme where it's like, you know, like opens pickle jar and Stilgar's like Lassa Agib. Like he's doing normal shit for people that live in the desert. He's not teaching anybody like the weirding way. He's not using the voice. He's not doing any of these godlike things. And we're supposed to read that as him like rejecting the power. And in case you don't get that, they literally tell you. Chani has a really interesting beginning, but by the end is just reduced to like disapproving looks. And then
gawking a lot.
All the villains in this story, we know they're bad because they slit the throats of the people who are working for them. And like all of those characters have been flattened. I was really worried about Florence Pugh, but she does have one good scene where she talks to the Reverend Mother. And I was like, okay, at
I
least
gotta say,
there will eventually be a character there.
I am so excited.
In which
actually,
movie?
For the good TV question. Show that they're doing later this year that's just about the Bene Gesserit.
That's true.
And that, like, that is where all the intrigue is. They're Patches, pulling all the strings. Patches, you really, the stakes seem high.
You're
there.
Really testing me here because, like, every fiber of my being wants to just let you cook, you know, and you're hating on Dune and not harp on the fact that you mispronounce a word that they say 37 times in the course of the movie.
Tell me that. What no, is it?
You know what? I'm not the Dune authority. It's not
Bene Gesserit, right?
What is Bene
Gesserit? It's a soft Gesserit. G, people.
Is it Gesserit?
Is it GIF or JIF?
At least Katie was with me in being wrong.
You know what?
I'll get it right by the TV show that comes out on HBO Max later.
I am only bringing this up to shame myself for having these intrusive thoughts while my dear friend and comrade in arms is speaking the Lord's truth. This is a me problem, and Patches is innocent.
But here's my question to you, David. You don't like this movie. And I would say I do like this movie. And that I get enough satisfaction out of what Villeneuve is doing on vibes, as many have said. Like, I do...
Just good vibes in this movie.
I like all the big pictures. You know what my favorite image in the movie is? That sandworm sand beater machine that they have a bunch of like cool close-ups of that, mm-hmm. like working and bringing sound design and the Zimmer score together to like strike terror in us. The worm is coming.
Yeah.
I like a lot of what the movie is doing.
Do you think
and
they lose those
us,
things but... when the sandworms come up and they just replace them endlessly? Do they go back and get them? I've wondered about this.
Yeah, that's a good question. Is it a dongle? Is it your AirPod lost in the sand? You're worried about it, or can you throw it away?
Imagine if every time you called an Uber, it took your phone with it.
Yeah. There is so much to like about it. I was less bored than in the first movie, which I had only seen at home. I never got to go to the theater to see the first Dune. It's hard to believe years ago when we weren't going to the movie theater so much and all the movies were premiering right on HBO Max where you could just see them at home. And it was a pleasure to see this in like a big screen at an AMC multiplex where the sound was booming. There's a lot to like here. I, David, wonder why you hate it or if that's how you feel. Where does it cross the line from just being like atrocious to you or maybe commodified or like stale. I don't know how you're really feeling about this and where it peters over from like there's nothing to enjoy.
I mean, I try to avoid saying this in these episodes. We record episodes after, you know, for the last few years, we've recorded about new movies after they've come out rather than around the embargo or the weekend of the release. In this case, I've written, I think, the longest first run review I've ever written for a movie that I knew it was going to be picked to death and really tried to parse my words and process the film to the best of my ability. It was exhausting, and the discourse and blowback after that, even though I've been spared the vast majority of it. I mean, this was a situation where I was regularly getting texts and emails from people I know who do not even regularly text or email me to say, oh, my buddy, I'm so sorry about the attacks that you're getting on social media. I just hope you're okay. And I was like, I am not seeing literally any of this. Katie, I think one of them may have been from you.
Yeah, I saw someone making fun of people making fun of you. And I was like, what's going
on? Yeah,
that
it's already trickled
gratified.
Down on several levels.
I was gratified to hear you say, I don't know.
I truly had not seen and still have not really seen a single iota of what that was. And that is not me asking for proof. I am happy with this, you know. Say what you will about Twitter, but its filtering system seems to be working for me. I clicked over to my For You tab and saw two tweets that had my name in them but were not added to me, and then immediately clicked away, and that was about as far as it got.
I did just search your name, and this guy said, it's just me, my girlfriend, and David Ehrlich against the world. Yeah. So your fans are still going.
Dave Gonzalez to the list. But right, so what I was meant to say at the start of this ramble was that... it's a disservice to our listeners. I'm extremely burnt out on thinking, talking, living with this movie. There's definitely a part of me that is enjoying secondhand, more vicariously, the enthusiasm that people have for it. You know, I'm always going to be supportive of a phenomenon that is driving people to theaters the way that this is. And the craftsmanship in these movies is foolish to try and attack. I mean, I may not always like what these surfaces are in service to, and how Denis Villeneuve seems to try and flatten the drama around them to resemble these brutalist structures that he make that are just completely stainless and fly without a single bump along the way. But they are impressive to look at. They're tactile. They are, in many cases, physical. It is sort of an embodiment of everything, the antithesis of everything that I hate so much about contemporary blockbuster filmmaking. And so for that, I appreciate these movies. And for the first 30 minutes of Dune Part 2, I was feeling similarly to the way I did in Dune Part 1, where I was like, you know what? Gotta hand it to him. I really feel like Denis Villeneuve has done it this time. I was sort of in. It starts, it starts at a full gallop, more or less, and has some early action sequences that are all propulsive and clearly shot and well choreographed. And Hans Zimmer, as I said, sort of freaking it over the soundtrack. And it peaks with
a lot of good synths in this movie. Very 80s, more 80s.
And it does have an 80s feel to it for sure. And Javier Bardem is front and center. He's my favorite part of the movie. He's front and center in that first chapter. And the worm riding sequence is extraordinary. And seeing it in the Dolby screening, I'm sure the sound was cranked all the way up at AMCs across the country. So I don't mean to flex too much privilege here, but seeing this on a non-IMAX screen, but in the Dolby screening room, was definitely... I could feel it rumbling on my spine, and that was fun. And then I sat there just in a downward spiral of boredom for 90 minutes, where I just found nothing to hang on to, like someone clawing desperately at the side of the shy Halul, for a place for the grappling
hook. How do they all get on the worm?
Yeah. I have a lot about this. Of questions about how they get on and
ride,
off the worm.
A lot of them ride the worms in the battle. How do they get on there?
I, like everyone in America, asked themselves this question and then was immediately filled with gratitude that Denis Villeneuve decided not to include a 10-minute scene that answered that question for me.
Maybe it'll be in the Bene Gesserit TV show.
All right, get on.
Yeah, but I've written at length about why I sort of struggle with Denis Villeneuve's sense of scale and how I find that it flattens a lot of the humanity in his films and the drama. There's sort of a droning quality to the way his narratives drudge forward. I think that in an archetypical story like Dune, which is obviously sort of at the birth of a genre and gave us so many of the things that have come to define that genre, I think it's not necessarily a great match between his sensibilities and the material. I think you see that a lot in Austin Butler's extremely, extremely boring character. I mean, I was bored of this guy before he even showed up, because they make the fatal mistake of having someone, maybe even Lea Seydoux, who shows up to under the skin him for five minutes, which was great.
Yeah, she does.
I mean, Lea Seydoux is always going to be the best part of any movie she's in, and this is no exception, even though it is just flagrant under the skin cosplay. But she is like, he's a psychopath. And like, that's really all there is to him. He's a pure psychopath.
He is Jared Leto Joker.
Yeah, I mean, but not even.
Unfortunately.
I mean,
like, doing a Stellan Skarsgård accent.
It's great, yeah. But like, that in and of itself is an uninteresting choice. I was like, okay, I clock it immediately. Yeah. He's doing a Stellan Skarsgård imitation. What more is there? He's, being his, wants to be his uncle. I get he's supposed to be dark Chalamet. Again, distracts from the texture of the Paul Atreides character, who obviously has his fair share of darkness percolating there, but I was so bored of Austin Butler's character. I think because of that boredom, it made it really hard for me to appreciate the monochromatic look of the Giddy Prime.
Oh, that was pretty cool, though.
Black and white sun.
I was so turned off by spending all this time to get nothing from this character other than watching, like, him gladiate some people. It put me in like a very Zack Snyder frame of mind, where I was just looking at these augmented.
There are some Zack Snyder
frames in this movie.
His visions of the future, his visions of the South are pure Rebel Moon Part 2 The Stargate.
Wait, you haven't even seen Rebel Moon Part 2.
I remember about once every 3 days that I have to see Rebel Moon Part 2 at some point. And it's a dark moment for me. What's the most pretentious that I can make this? Like Milan Kundera writing in The Unbearable Lightness of Being about how relationships crumble once the metaphor that gave birth to their love ceases to exist. I find in a movie like this, when you begin to emotionally disengage from it and start to pull away from what it's doing and not give characters the benefit of the doubt of the storytelling. It's almost impossible to get back on board. And I found, and I am perplexed as Dune Part 2 goes on by how little investment it asks of you in so much of the drama that's happening around it. I mean, it becomes, you know, a very clear narrative that, I mean, it builds up to this big battle, which is a complete fart in the wind. It's over in a second, as it was in the books, but I don't think that's necessarily an excuse for, you know, this is a different medium and it demands different things.
Why do you need the, I mean, it's a long movie. Why do you need more battle at that point when you kind of know it's leading?
And then you have like this very anticlimactic and silly knife fight. I mean, all this stuff pulls away from what I am.
I think the knife fight hit.
The silence of that knife fight is incredible after all that noise.
No Zimmer there.
Almost nothing about the movie was working for me by the time we were at the halfway point. And then it's simply just, you know, leaning deeper and deeper into those things, exacerbating them. Really struggle with it. Completely disengaged with all the characters. Wanted to leave with Leia Seydoux when she checked out. Could not care less about I mean, I do think Zendaya does a good job. I saw some people ragging on her performance. I think that she has a narrow register.
I don't think she has a lot to do.
She doesn't have a lot. She certainly has more to do in the first movie.
I think she's great.
She's
really doing a lot.
I'm excited for Challengers because I need a good movie from her.
Yeah.
I need something.
And I think hopefully
she's really good in this. Are you kidding me?
Her role more flexible in that. But I like what she brings to this movie. I think that I like how she negotiates her attraction to Paul and her feelings for him with her suspicions of him as a savior and her suspicions of the prophecy. I mean, I think all of these things, I think that she does a good job of navigating, but
I think her face is such a barometer through the whole movie. Like, you're kind of looking to her to figure out if Paul is going in the right direction or not. And her skepticism of him is really essential for kind of translating for all the rest of the Fremen in the beginning and kind of seeing the challenge he has to overcome. And then as he kind of embraces his fate, it cuts back to her over and over again to kind of remind you of what's really happening here. I mean, the movie ends on her face. Like, she is the audience surrogate by the end of this movie. And I think it's not that it's one scene. It's like the end is
really good.
The continuing reliance on her as being the movie's emotional core, which you do not expect to happen at the beginning of the movie. It's a pretty impressive transformation. Mm. I mean, you know, not transformation. The character doesn't change. But
I wouldn't
say
that I didn't expect that after they cast Zendaya in the first movie and have her essentially just say,
"David, excuse me, it's Zendaya, as in Zendaya is Meiji."
I wasn't going to chime in and reclaim my pronunciation.
I mean, I've already shamed myself. gone out of my way to do so in this episode. So I welcome
Zendaya is Meiji. We all know that, and that is how you say her name.
I think I knew that, and then just got it completely twisted in my head. But anyway, be that as it may, what were we saying? I can't remember. Dune bad.
who are the MVPs of the movie? Katie, if you think there are solid performances here, Dave, maybe there's things that you did enjoy, but like, there's so many people in this movie. Mm-hmm. There's so much time given to them, even if the drama is light, but like, there's some good performances, I think. Who are your MVPs, Katie?
I mean, Timothée Chalamet, I think, is really great in this movie. And like, halfway through the movie, I was like, wow, I'm like really getting on the Chalamet train. I was like, no, I've never not been on the Chalamet
angry
train.
Chalamet. Yes. I like when he turns.
I just love that this and Wonka came 3 months apart and we're always going to, even before it got delayed. And it's not like he has range. It's not like he's transforming. He's not doing an Austin Butler thing where you're trying to find him under there, but he's just using his little spindly instrument in such incredibly different ways in those two movies, and holds the center of this really complicated movie with a character that's really hard to wrap your arms around. I think he does a great job with it.
I like it when he embraces Dark Paul as well, but doesn't really work for me up until then. I do think Zendaya does the best what she has. I don't think anybody's necessarily at fault there. And I also think Florence Pugh does as much with metallic headdresses as she possibly can.
Yeah, Florence Pugh is much like Oppenheimer, where you're like, Florence Pugh, glad you're here. Bye.
Yeah,
wish we had you longer.
She's the Zendaya of this movie.
I love her. She is the Zendaya of this movie.
Anya Taylor-Joy, I think, is the Zendaya of this movie.
Anya Taylor-Joy is supposed to be in this movie. Yeah, she does.
But
she is in it.
I will say, this is one of the only times in my life I have felt that Christopher Walken was badly miscast. Badly. He is completely out of place in this universe. He is only giving Christopher Walken every single time the Emperor is on screen, which isn't often, but they're all pivotal scenes. All I can think of is there's Christopher Walken. He's totally disengaged from the drama around him, and not in the way that the Emperor is sort of divorced from the wars that he is. Walken? You know, the king.
Can you say something in your bad Walken impression?
Power is spice.
The Muad'Dib is coming to Arrakis.
I like in theory the idea of the Emperor being somewhat aloof because he is playing a game of chess with all these pawns. But I think in practice, it is a complete black hole where there needs to be some sort of dramatic friction going on here, and it doesn't work like so much in this movie. Who would I have cast? I think I would have cast Javier Bardem. I think he should have played every role in this film.
It would have been from Lyle.
He is really having fun. Good for him.
I love him in all the scenes where he's like getting extremely excited for the Messiah to arrive.
You know what I have
cast? He's done it. Yes.
I haven't thought about this for more than 5 seconds, but I'm just sticking with like my favorite.
As the Emperor, you mean?
Right. You're right. Exactly. My favorite European actors, because I was just thinking in context of Stellan Skarsgård and like who else from his world, if not from Lars von Trier, then maybe from like some adjacent cinema. And I arrived at the Belgian actor Olivier Gourmet, star of many Arden Brothers films. Yeah, I know. I'm up my butthole like the down the dune popcorn bucket or whatever metaphor you want to use. But that guy, I think, has the right energy. Google him, look him up, watch a YouTube.
Well, in contrast, I'm going to go with Larry the Cable Guy as the Emperor.
What about Larry David?
Muad'Dib.
When are we going to talk about Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Didn't we already talk about Curb Your Enthusiasm?
We just talked about Curb Your Enthusiasm.
When are we going to talk about it? I mean, again, in light of the incredible most recent episode of that show, the Disney Store. Amazing.
Well, hopefully people write in with reviews and we had reclaim our mini segment with you checking in with Curb, maybe. But Dune Part 2, it's still in theaters. It's doing pretty well, but has to beat Kung Fu Panda 4 this weekend. So I assume that you've seen it, but if you've gotten this far to the review, but maybe you want to see it again. I don't know. It's a theatrical patches to answer your question from the beginning. I think this is sticky because it's a great theatrical experience.
And because fuck the popcorn bucket.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to fuck the popcorn bucket. But like,
I still don't understand how the hole is quite large.
I mean,
having now seen it in person.
Fair. But maybe that's something people want to write into at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com.
Can I share
no pictures?
Can I share one more tweet about David? That's not going to make anybody feel bad before
we wrap
this up.
It's
not
going to
make you feel bad. No, it won't. This is from someone who says David Ehrlich is hit or miss with me, but he's kind of cute.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Look at that.
There you go.
Dune part two.
See you in the desert, buddy.
That does it for this week's show. We will be back next week. We're going to talk about the Oscars and I guess Kung Fu Panda 4 because I'm seeing it as the event of the century in my house, and I guess everybody else feels like seeing it too, which
now
is
we have
a delight to me personally. So that'll be next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches, executive editor at Polygon. I am on Blue Sky and Letterboxd at Mr. Patches, and we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to old episodes. I'm sure we had a lively conversation about the first Dune, where some people didn't like it and others did. You should actually have listened to that first. What's wrong with you? Go back and listen to Dune 1 review and then Dune 2 review, silly.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the film critic at IndieWire. You can find me on X, at David Ehrlich, and all the other things at David Ehrlich. You can find my review of Dune Part 2 on IndieWire, and if you were as annoyed with me during our Dune segment as I imagine many of you were, I would point you in that direction because I was at least more cogent there. What a word to stumble on than I was here, but also very long. Anyway, you can find all of us together In the fuck, I was really hoping I would be able to come up with the name of the little desert enclave where they live in Dune Part 2 by the time I got to this part of the sentence. Someone help me out.
Fremen Town.
The Siege. Thank you. You can find us all at The Siege. And a very important aside, I'm so glad I dragged the episode to a halt for this. And you can also find all of us together on Fighting at the War Room at the Apple Podcast app. Leave us a review. You haven't done that in several weeks. Or we are going to talk about Marvel Snap and or the shitty American version of The Traitor. If you do not have access to the American version of the Apple Podcast app store, whatever the fuck, you can email us. Dave, where can they do that?
You can email us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name, D-A-7-E. I'm that on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd. Also part of the Trial by Content podcast over on The Ringer. And we just did Best Movie Set in the Desert. So I got to watch like Lawrence of Arabia after Dune Part 2. Check out that podcast if you're at all interested.
I'm Katie Rich. While I was searching David's name on Twitter, I saw someone saying, I'm seeing people out here saying Dune Part 2 is better than Lawrence of Arabia. I don't think that's real. If you are saying that, I would ask you to check yourself before you wreck yourself. Lawrence of Arabia, unmatched. You can find me at Vanity Fair. I'll be covering the Oscars, as you probably know, on the Little Gold Men podcast, and then also on this one. Find me on Twitter, where I keep coming back, on Blue Sky, and on Letterboxd at Katie Rich. And I'm on Instagram at Katie Rich Talking. I'm trying out an Instagram that everyone can see and not just people who I actually know. We'll see how that goes. We're all on mostly Twitter at FITWR, where you can tell us your favorite thing you've mispronounced from the world of Dune, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Kung Fu Panda 4 in theaters this weekend, seems like a good time to ask, what is DreamWorks Animation's best movie?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.